Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, the unscripted show that celebrates unsung heroes, myth busts historical lies, and rediscovers the forgotten stories that changed our world. I'm your host, Scott Rank.
On October 15, 1950, General Douglas MacArthur, who at the time was Supreme Commander of UN troops in Korea, convinced President Harry Truman that communist forces of Kim Il-sung would be utterly defeated by Thanksgiving. He said very confidently, as MacArthur often did, that the Chinese would never intervene in the war. But as he was speaking, 300,000 Red Chinese soldiers began to cross the Manchurian border secretly. Even though MacArthur and his staff took intelligence warnings as fiction, the 1st Marine Division began to move deeply into the snowy mountains of North Korea toward the trap that Mao had set for MacArthur along the frozen shores of the Chosin Reservoir. With these 20,000 Marines pinned down, what followed was one of the most harrowing operations in American military history. Trapped in the mountains with temperatures 20 degrees below zero, the Marines had to hold off a massive numerical disadvantage against Chinese soldiers and somehow evacuate a convoy 13 miles long of vehicles, even though there were almost no roads and all infrastructure like bridges was being blown up, and they had to improvise rebuilding the infrastructure on the fly as they were being pinned down by enemy soldiers, fighting battle constantly. Today I'm speaking with Hampton Sides, author of the new book On Desperate Ground, The Marines at the Reservoir, The Korean War's Greatest Battle. We talk about one of the most important battles in 20th century history, yet something that has been largely overlooked, even though this battle and the Korean War at large set the stage for really the geopolitical fate of the entire Pacific world for the 20th century and leading up into the 21st century. So I hope you enjoyed this discussion with Hampton Sides. First of all, before we get into this battle, which for many people, unless they've studied the Korean War, don't know much about, I have a question for you about the Korean War. Off the air, I was talking with you about how I get approached by so many book authors about World War II and the Holocaust, which by all means is important to understand. But it seems in perspective, the Korean War has been heavily overlooked. You're only the second guest I've had to talk about the Korean War. And even though our geopolitical focus is increasingly looking toward East Asia for our challenges in the future, and even though the Korean War did much to set the stage for where the United States is now in relations to events in East Asia, the Korean War seems to be heavily overlooked. And I'm wondering, why do you think this is? Do you think this is fair or unfair?
Oh, yeah, I think it's tremendously unfair, not only to these men who fought in it, but to really kind of does a disservice to history because, you know, it was such an important war in so many ways, being our modern world, and in also in terms of, you know, the great ideological battle that was being fought during the Cold War with the Russians and to a lesser extent with the Chinese. So it's a very it is an overlooked war, and I've certainly done a little thinking on why that may be. I think it's a lot of little reasons. One of them being that Truman himself, President Truman, called it a UN police action, and the nomenclature of that war kind of proceeded from that it wasn't really a war, that it was somehow a limited war or a war, some sort of proxy war. Perhaaps it was a civil war that we just kind of glommed onto. These diminutives like this action or conflict kind of take away the power and the drama and the huge stakes that were involved in this battle. And I've really come to think of the Korean War as a world war that was fought in a very limited piece of geography, testing the waters for this larger conflict that was going on between Stalin and Mao and Truman to figure out and wrestle with the bigger idea of what was the future, you know, post-World War II world going to look like.
Right. There's a lot of moving parts here. And as we enter into this, your book focuses specifically on the Chosin Reservoir and the battle that takes place there. But let's set the stage with 1950. What are the events leading up to this that we should be aware of? And what are people on the ground thinking? Are they assuming, like generals in the beginning of the Civil War, that this is a inevitable conflict that will be over soon, or are they digging in their heels for a long war? What do they see at this point?
Well, I think the United States was grossly unprepared for what became the Korean War, you know, the surprise incursion from the north by Kim Il-sung and his army, his Soviet-trained, Soviet-equipped army. We didn't seem to see it coming, even though there was ample intelligence that something was brewing. So, you know, some of the, just to sort of set the geopolitical stage, there, you know, Mao had recently won his civil war against the nationalist forces of Chiang Kai-shek. Chiang Kai-shek had decamped to Taiwan, and China was really trying to figure out how to stage a massive amphibious invasion of Taiwan and capture those last remaining forces. That's kind of what their focus was on the eve of the Korean War. Meanwhile, Stalin was focused almost, you know, exclusively on Eastern Europe and trying to kind of win over that block of Eastern European countries in this ideological conflict that was going on between capitalism and communism, shortly after World War II. The other factor in all this is MacArthur, General MacArthur, who was running the occupation of Japan from Tokyo, and was actually, you know, for all his faults, and those who've read my book know I am no fan of MacArthur, but he was actually quite good at this one job, running the occupation. I mean, he was essentially the emperor, and trying to rewire that society. And I think he kind of viewed events in Korea as kind of an extension of the greater sphere of influence emanating from Japan. We had not really done a very good job of articulating the extent to which we would defend South Korea in the event of some kind of invasion from the north. And we somehow didn't see it coming. Came across that border in June of 1950 with his army. They steamrolled right through South Korea. They took Seoul, the capital, in just a few days, and quite nearly took the entire peninsula. Before we kind of regrouped, got some troops in there, the UN reacted, got some troops in there, and began to get a foothold in the south and began to plan for the massive Incheon invasion, which turned the war back around in the Allies' favor.
Before we get too far into the battle, I have a question for you as someone who has researched extensively on MacArthur, because I think he benefits from this the World War II halo and rebuilding Japan and the MacArthur plan and other things. But those who are a little bit more studied in military history recognize his numerous faults, and they love to point out this take on him and his many flaws. So to set the stage on maybe how the United States is not correctly estimating Chinese commitment to North Korea, how would you describe MacArthur's faults to someone who really only knows of him as this victorious figure in World War II and not much else?
Yeah. Well, he is a larger-than-life character. Everything he did was, you know, grand and grandiose, and it was all about him. They used to say he was in love with the vertical pronoun, I shall return, not seeming to recognize that there was an entire army and navy behind him. He was an I guy, not a we guy, not a collaborative guy at all. And he was micro-attentive to the nuances of media, and you know how he looked on camera. He was an actor in some ways. He was quite dramatic. He was brilliant, although usually the first to admit it. He was someone who was deeply versed in military history and kind of thought and carried himself like some great general from the distant past, maybe like Napoleon or something. And he spoke in terms of, you know, these grand maneuvers and smiting blows and anvils. And, you know, he was kind of like out of a page of history, not in some ways a modern general, although except for his understanding of media, he was very clear on kind of projecting his image in the world. The biggest problem with MacArthur by this point is that he had surrounded himself with a bunch of yes men in Tokyo who did his bidding and told him what he wanted to hear, so that his intelligence was limited. He had a vision for what he thought the war was going to be, how it was going to end, and anything that interfered with that vision, he just didn't want to hear about it. And so this set the stage for this massive intelligence failure, one of the largest ones in American military history, in which 300,000 Chinese troops moved into Manchuria, moved across the Yalu River, moved into North Korea, and got into place around the Chosun Reservoir and other key strategic places in North Korea. And we somehow didn't know about it. And even when we began to know about it, we didn't act on it. And so I think that MacArthur, as you say, he has this kind of halo over his head from World War II. We're looking at a very different MacArthur now. He's a little past his expiration date. He's trying to run a war from afar, truly the definition of an absentee general, because he's in Tokyo, and he likes his creature comforts there. He likes his world that he set up there in the capital. And he never spent a single night on Korean soil during the entire Korean War. He had his various generals and advisors telling him what was going on, but there was a disconnect there, and it really affected all the decision-making that led up to this battle.
That adds an interesting dimension to this of the Marines succeeding despite their overall command structure, not because of it, which is enormously challenging to add on to the conditions they're facing. But let's not jump ahead too far in the narrative. So how do the Allies first get word of the 300,000 soldiers in the Red Army crossing the Manchurian border? And what are some of the initial reactions to this?
Well, the first solid intelligence that came in was from some skirmishes, some battles, small battles that were encountered as the Marines pushed up into that mountainous country of North Korea around Chosun Reservoir. During these smaller sized battles, prisoners were captured and they were interrogated. And lo and behold, they were Chinese. They were Chinese regular army troops that Mao had sent down, and they were amazingly forthcoming. They would say, we're here. We've been here for a month. There's more coming. There's hundreds of thousands of us. We're from this unit. It was pretty stunning intelligence that was sent up the chain of command to Tokyo. And MacArthur's intelligence chief and his other high-ranking officers chose to interpret this information in a completely different way. They said, these are just some volunteers. Many of them are Koreans, North Koreans who happen to live in Manchuria, who've come down. They're like guerrillas. They're irregular. They're rogue forces. Anything but regular army, signifying that Mao is here and is committed to defending this part of North Korea. So that's where the intelligence failure becomes a leadership failure for me, because, it's like they willingly misinterpreted, in some cases even doctored the evidence so that they could tell the Joint Chiefs of Staff and President Truman back in Washington, there's nothing to worry here. We're just going to keep marching. The Chinese are not going to enter the war. War is going to be over, and certainly by Christmas. And don't worry about it. We got this.
With the 20,000 soldiers in the 1st Marine Division, what leads them to confront the Red Army at first when they're getting this rose-colored view of what's actually happening on the ground from their command?
Mm-hmm. Interesting about this battle is that you have a field general, the commander of the 1st Marine Division, beginning to see what's on the ground. All these Chinese troops surrounding him in this impossible terrain as winter is setting in. And yet from the top, he's getting, as you say, this rosy picture. Like, don't worry about it. There's not a problem. There's not going to be a battle. you know, just keep marching as fast as you can to the Yalu River, which is the border with Manchuria. And so General Smith has to thread a needle. You know, he has to be very careful. He doesn't want to be he doesn't want to disobey orders. He doesn't want to be convicted of insubordination court-martialed. But he does, you know, he does realize that there's a battle that's about to happen, and so he slows down deliberately. Precautions that MacArthur doesn't understand, like building airfields up there and building enormous supply depots and, you know, basically girding his loins for a battle that he sees coming, and seemingly he's the only one who sees it coming. So, you know, it's an interesting study in leadership. You know, how do you as a lower level general who's in possession of the facts on the ground, you know, how do you negotiate this complicated situation where your superiors are telling you something radically different from what you are observing on the ground?
Right. How did he thread that needle? Because that is, I think, arguably a much more common situation for a general or an officer in different situations than somebody who is in a chain of command where everyone is responding rationally to the facts, especially in, I don't know, tin pot dictatorships where a military can sometimes be intentionally kept weak because you don't want a military coup. And the leader of the military might then declare himself president. So there's politicized elements to military as well. So I could see this scenario playing out over and over and over again. So I'm curious, how did he initially thread this needle of reacting to the facts that are in front of him, yet also maintaining the polite fiction that's being maintained at the top?
Well, that is really what is so remarkable about General Smith. He you know, his discretion, his tact. He was a guy who clearly seemed to know how to pick his battles, and you know, was very careful in his language. He did write some very pointed and very eloquent letters to the command structure within the Marine Corps, particularly to the Commandant of the Marines, a letter that basically laid out the situation as he saw it. Like, here I am between a rock and a hard place, and there's, you know, I see a battle coming. They don't seem to, you know, understand what we're about to experience here. They, you know, basically wanting someone within the command structure to know the predicament that he was in. The other thing he did is just, you know, not so much to violate orders from above, but just to slow down. You know, yeah, they're going to keep going north, but they're going much more cautiously than MacArthur seemed to want. And this was very frustrating to MacArthur, but they were slowing down. They were, you know, heading up into these mountains that had twisting, narrow hairpin turns, and, you know, it's just ambush country, classic ambush country. And instead of just storming up that road, he slowed down and he put out patrols on the flanks and he sent men up to the ridge lines. And, you know, that kind of leapfrogging is very slow and deliberate and cautious. And so these were some of the things that he did and some of the decisions he made. The airstrip, the airfield that I mentioned earlier, was a huge decision that he made, that saving lots of lives, because he knew there were going to be casualties. There's going to be a battle. And of course, a lot of those casualties ended up being weather casualties because it was so cold. So many men died of exposure or were seriously injured by frostbite in this battle. So these are these are some of the kinds of precautions that Smith undertook, and somehow managed to do it without getting himself fired in the process. And I think it's just a fascinating study in leadership to figure out how he did that. And, you know, even after the battle, he was very careful and very tactful in the way he described it. He was a very modest guy. He didn't take credit himself for any of this. And for all these reasons, within the Marine Corps, General Smith is revered as, you know, just this, you know, this great general, yes, but also seemingly exactly the right temperament for the situation that the Marines encountered.
Right. And as Smith and the 1st Marine Division are moving into the mountains, the place that they find themselves at is the Chosin Reservoir. And you note that Mao had set a trap for MacArthur along its shores. Was Mao expecting this quick dash there without the adequate supply chain and airfields? And so what's happening here? Is this a place that Mao was expecting to pinch them down, or did it just happen that the two sides dug in their heels here?
Well, the Chosin Reservoir was a very important installation. It was a man-made lake. It had been built by the Japanese during the Japanese occupation of Korea, during World War II or prior to World War II. And the Chinese had signaled for weeks that this was an important installation that they would protect because it generated a lot of power that fed deep into these networks in Manchuria. They needed this power. They depended on it for electricity, for some manufacturing that they had. And so it was an important place that they wanted to protect. That's the first thing. The second thing is I think that it was perfect terrain for an encirclement. Mao's army did not use the roads at all. They didn't have vehicles. They were a foot army. And so they came across the mountains and were able to completely encircle this Chosin Reservoir country without being spotted very much. Obviously, some had been captured, and we knew they were there, but they hid up in the mountains, and they were really good at this kind of movement. This was one of the great strengths of their army, was that they were not dependent upon the roads, and they were really good at moving at night, undetected. They had suppleness of movement and the element of surprise, and these were some of the strengths that they hoped to rely on as they encircled this lake. The other factor is that there was really only one main road in this part of North Korea, so there was no doubt where the Marines were going to be as they came north. They were going to be using this one road that led to Hagaru, a village on the shores of the lake. So in some ways, all those vehicles that made us on paper such a superior army actually could be seen as a vulnerability because we were tied to the roads. We were almost enslaved by the roads. We had to go that one route. And so it's a perfect example of what we now call asymmetrical warfare, two very different kinds of armies that are coming into place and sizing each other up for their various strengths and weaknesses. And that's kind of the eve of the battle as we move into November of 1950.
Hey everyone, Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors. Let's look at the first stages of the battle. The Marines, as you mentioned, are in terrible danger of being completely wiped out. They're heavily outnumbered, pinned down. They're relying on a form of warfare that does depend on vehicles in the way that the Chinese army is not. So in those early stages, what do they do to innovate and organize to be able to stand their ground?
Yeah. Well, the first few days, the Marines are really just holding on for dear life. I mean, they're just absorbing this onslaught of the Chinese army. The Chinese army relied on surprise. They also would only fight at night because they were terrified of American air superiority, and so the planes couldn't fly at night. So they were free to attack. They usually would attack at night, and there would be this cacophony of horns and bells and whistles and drums, which was the way the Chinese communicated with each other across the hillsides because they didn't have radios for the most part. So they attacked at night, wave after wave after wave of of these Chinese soldiers in with these bleeding horns and bugles and drums and just pounding in the night. And it was terrifying for the Marines at first to hear all this cacophony of noise. But the Chinese, this is sort of how they communicated across the mountains, because they didn't have radios. The Chinese were willing to tolerate, Mao was willing to tolerate, casualties that we would consider obscene. You know, just the first wave would just get mowed down, and the second wave would come and pick up the rifles of and other weapons of that first wave. And so, you know, for the first few days, the Marines, really all they could do was tighten their perimeters and absorb, you know, just hold on for dear life. But they also began to formulate a plan. You know, first of all, they realized they weren't going north anymore. You know, that was a fiction. They're not going to march to the Yalu. The war is not over by Christmas. All that optimism from a few days ago coming from MacArthur's office, that's all over. What they got to do now is bring all the Marines together into one location and create kind of like a citadel, you know, a bastion, a stronghold that they can hold as they plan a breakout, a march back down the mountains to the sea, where an enormous evacuation was being planned on the order of Dunkirk. So for those first few days, they brought these various scattered elements, bringing these enclaves, you know, merging them into one big enclave, which is Hagaru, which is where the airfield was. And this is where General Smith's headquarters was. So that was stage one, bring all the troops together like a chicken who brings, her chicks all together into one location. And then phase two, plan an organized and well choreographed breakout fighting march to the sea.
Well, how do soldiers improvise as the initial wave wears off and they have to figure out how to kind of blast their way out of this trap that they've fallen into?
Well, one of the ways they improvise is, you know, really has to do with the weather. Very seldom in our history have we had sustained hostilities going on in weather like this, because by this point it was 30 below zero and weapons weren't firing properly, and men were freezing, and they, you know, it was just like, you know, the batteries were dying quickly. Everything slowed down. And they had to build this airfield that I mentioned earlier, and they had to dig into this essentially almost like permafrost. By this point, it was frozen solid, and the engineers are out there scraping the soil and welding all these teeth onto these bulldozer pans to scrape at the frozen soil and to create an airfield in the middle of a wilderness, in a place where no airfield would normally be, and they're doing this while fighting a battle. You know, the marine engineers are working bulldozers, occasionally picking up their rifle and firing. It is extraordinary how much of this battle becomes a story of the engineers who have to improvise solutions and make things work in these extreme weather conditions. They would keep the vehicles running all night, because if they ever turned the engine off, they were terrified that they wouldn't be able to get them to start again. They became tied to their vehicles. I mean, the vehicles essentially kept them warm. You see these pictures of men leaning against jeeps and tanks and, you know, just trying to get any kind of warmth they could from their own vehicles. But the vehicles also were, you know, a source of danger, because the Chinese knew where they were. They were in those vehicles. So anyone who was driving a jeep or an ambulance was a target, and most of the drivers got shot. It's an unusual battlefield scenario by any means, whether you're talking about the terrain, the weather, fighting on the shores of a now completely frozen lake, with one road that is your exit. You know, there's only one road up there, and there's only one road out.
What were battle scenes that stuck out to you as you were researching this and surprised you?
Well, the first couple of nights, the battle scenes were just, you know, trying to, the Marines trying to get accustomed to fighting at nighttime in the garish light of these flares, you know, in snow-lit, moon-lit mountains. It's kind of eerie. It's kind of an eerie way to fight and you know, to have these waves of Chinese soldiers coming at them, trying to figure out, you know, how to fight them best. And you know, there's a number of key places on the battlefield, which is, the battlefield is really spread out over a pretty good stretch of terrain, about 40 miles along that road. But one of the key places is a place called Fox Hill, which was a hill that was guarding a hairpin turn in that road. And it was a place the Marines needed to hold at all costs. Fox Company was sent up there to hold that road, and they did. All they sustained just horrible casualties. And I follow in the book a number of guys who were on Fox Hill and who had to, you know, hold off the Chinese night after night for 5 nights till they were finally relieved. You know, just the story of Fox Hill alone is just a fascinating study in courage and really, you know, I mean, the thing about this battle is that there was so many individual acts of heroism. The extreme conditions of the battlefield, I think, brought that out in these guys to an unusual extent. It's one of our most decorated battles because. You know, you're when you're fighting like this, hand-to-hand combat, often using shovels and, you know, knives and bayonets in these kinds of conditions, you know, it just brings out a different survival instinct that is pretty unusual in our battles.
Yeah, and I want to get back to that on the actual fighting, but your description of the conditions that the Marines faced, it made me think of something. Generals are often criticized for fighting the last war, that in the beginning of the battles in Afghanistan and Iraq in the early 2000s, there was still lingering elements of a Cold War mentality of fighting a standard army that had to be adapted to, in some ways, guerrilla warfare. I could imagine the tactics that initially would be used on the ground would have been crafted according to fighting in the Pacific theater in World War II, where you're on Pacific islands, maybe you have flamethrowers or other weapons to try to root out nests of soldiers bunkered into hills, with the confidence that you have air superiority overhead. Was there any element of that in this being the first parts of the Korean War, where there's these lingering tactics held over from World War II that they had to adapt out of and do things, like you said, fight nighttime battles, fight in cold conditions, fight hand to hand and everything else?
Yeah. You know, all the officers in the 1st Marine Division, nearly all of them had fought in the island hopping campaigns of the Pacific and were experienced in that kind of warfare and, you know, amphibious landings on islands, marching into the jungles, rooting out an enemy that was, you know, dug in. That's probably a vision of the Marine Corps that, you know, that's what they'd always been used for, is amphibious, you know, landings and taking an island by storm and holding it long enough for the army to arrive and take it over. That's the kind of the way the Marines liked to view themselves, and they had trained to be an amphibious force. Now here they are going inland hundreds of miles up in really cold weather. And these officers who had fought at Iwo Jima and Okinawa and Peleliu are having to say, this isn't what Marines are supposed to do. This is not how we're supposed to be used. And this isn't how we trained. But they did adapt. They figured it out, and they're very proud of it. You know, the Marine Corps has in their sort of pantheon of battles that they study and celebrate, you know, just a handful that really, really stand out. And Chosin Reservoir is one of them. It's, you know, it's a battle that they embrace, they're proud of, how they acquitted themselves in those mountains in a completely alien terrain to what most people think the Marines are trained for.
What are other aspects that are celebrated? I mean, you mentioned the terrible conditions, the terrible cold, fighting at night, sometimes many times in close quarters. What are other elements that really stand out in the Marine Corps lore?
Well, you know, the rest of the battle after that first 4 or 5 days becomes the story of this breakout. A breakout is a complicated thing. And of course, one way to define the breakout is that it's a retreat. And of course, the Marines do not like to use the word retreat. And there's a lot of euphemisms for retreat in the military jargon. I you know, I get a kick out of some of the terms like retrograde maneuver or, you know, an advance to the rear. General Smith said, we're not retreating. We're simply attacking in another direction, which is a great little bit of verbal gymnastics and something I try to use in, you know, here in my household with my family. You know, like, no, I'm just attacking in another direction. But that is that's what they were doing, because when you're completely surrounded on all sides by an enemy that's determined to annihilate you, that's numerically superior, movement in any direction is by definition a fight. It's an attack. Smith's goal was to get to lower ground, to get to a position that he could hold. And, you know, he didn't know there was going to be an evacuation. He thought they were going to just get to a place down in the valley where he could hold indefinitely, maybe hold through the winter and regroup in the spring. So the Marines celebrate the idea that this was a fighting retreat, which is one of the most difficult maneuvers there is in warfare. You know, it's hard to defend yourself when you're dug in, but when you're moving with tanks and vehicles and airplanes and, you know, artillery and wounded, trying to get all those people out and even get your dead out if you can, is a very tricky thing that involves tons of planning, tons of logistics, tons of engineering. And this is where Smith shines, because he had that kind of mindset. He was a planner. He was a very methodical guy. He was an intellectual. He was someone who worked closely with the engineers. And he saw this as an enormous puzzle that needed to be solved, or his division was going to be wiped out. And so they went to work. And this is the thing that's really celebrated by the Marine Corps, is the notion of a well-choreographed fighting embracing this notion that sometimes in a battle there's really only one thing you can do, and that's to get out of that situation as smartly and, you know, as safely as you can, and get to a place that you can defend and fight another day. And that's what, you know, this is a textbook example of that.
And that shows his maturity as a general, because it's far more glorious, of course, to lead your troops into battle and march into France on VE Day. But to organize a disciplined retreat is, I would think, really shows your level of combat maturity, since if it's disorganized, that's where troops get killed in massive numbers. That's where militaries are completely dispirited and public opinion can shift so that the war effort loses whatever energy it had. Marching into
I was going to say, on the west side of the peninsula, while the Chosin Reservoir battle is happening, there's a whole nother story going on with the 8th Army and with some other UN forces that are over on that side. And at certain points, they just turned and ran. And, you know, it was a disorganized, just hell for leather retreat. And a lot of people got killed because that's actually a dangerous way to get out of a situation. It's just to run like hell. They called it the Great Bug Out. And, you know, you can kind of study what was happening on the west side of the peninsula and compare it to the Marine exit from Chosin, and you sort of see two different stories and two different ways in which you extricate yourself from an ordeal.
Hey everyone, Scott here. One more brief word from our sponsors. Well, let's look at the end of this, at the Battle of the Chosin Reservoir. How do the Marines successfully extricate themselves?
Well, hundreds of little choke points along the way that had to be defended. In one particular place, a bridge was blown by the Chinese over this great chasm, and the Marines had to figure out a way to rebuild a bridge by bringing in by parachute huge girders, and rebuilding a bridge within hours, you know, is essentially a massive exodus of thousands and thousands and thousands of Marines and their vehicles and their wounded, and in some cases their dead, fighting their way, you know, from point to point to point during this long serpentine 70-mile road. You know, it becomes a series of battles along the way with certain key places that have to be defended at all costs. Meanwhile, they have to kind of fold up their operations and close down their enclaves in a systematic way until the final plane leaves the airfield from Hagaru. And to choreograph all that and to time it all is extremely tricky stuff. And but they were able to do it, and they got 4,000 casualties out of there from this airfield. These were big planes that were coming in. It was, you know, it almost has a quality of the Berlin airlift in the way that they were bringing in supplies and bringing out casualties and doing this while the Chinese were firing on these planes the whole time. But they do get out. They get their way to the sea. And I think the Marines were kind of hoping they were going to stay there and hold that position in Hung Nam for the winter. But no, by this point, even MacArthur had figured out, no, we've got to get those guys out of there, get them to the south, get them, you know, regroup, let them regroup and lick their wounds and reorganize for battles that would be coming early in 1951.
One follow-up, I was really intrigued by your description of having to build this bridge in the matter of hours. What did that look like? I mean, my imagination was, as these parts are being parachuted down, they're being assembled and trusses are being put up the exact second that their weight can be supported, and then the next one has to go out and out. Or what did that look like, to have to build something that would normally take, you know, weeks or months of meticulous planning in a very short amount of time, but could mean death if you do it wrong?
Yeah, I mean, just seat of the pants kind of improvisational stuff. Like, I don't know, let's try this. They'd never built a bridge this way. And as they dropped those girders by parachute, some of them, you know, drifted off in the wrong direction and the Chinese got them, or they hit the ground too hard and were irreparably damaged. And, but they managed to get just enough of these trusses, and other pieces together to kind of improvise a solution that worked well enough to support the weight of all these vehicles and tanks that were part of this long convoy. It's something like 13 or 14 miles of vehicles that had to get across this chasm. General Smith had this chief engineer, this guy John Partridge, who was kind of the hero of the day. He came up with the solution, and you know, often the engineers are the unsung heroes of battles. You know, they build bridges and they build airfields and they repair roads just in the nick of time sometimes. And that was certainly the case here. It almost had a biblical feel to it of, you know, like this mass exodus and, you know, parting the Red Sea kind of thing. And you know, suddenly they get to a point, this long convoy of humanity marching out of those mountains, they get to a point where there's a chasm and the road is, there's just no way around it. And the road has been blown, the bridge has been blown. Partridge had to solve that problem in a matter of hours, and it's really quite heroic and quite an amazing picture of ingenuity and improvisation that I think the Marines can rightly point, you know, proudly say they're is one of their specialties. They often don't have something in their manual that says how to do something. They just figure something out, and that's what they had to do here.
What were other things, little stories like that, that really jumped at you of improvisation or fighting these impromptu battles before they were completely evacuated?
Well, I mean, one of the more grotesque part of this was that, you know, because the soil was so frozen, so cold, they ended up having instead to pile corpses, frozen corpses, up in these windbreaks that they hid behind. And the Chinese did this as well, but, you know, essentially, you know, it's a battle of men hiding behind the corpses of their enemy day after day after day. And it certainly gives it's something very grotesque about this battle, is that there are just corpses everywhere that, you know, froze in these weird positions, you know, because they froze in the position that they fell in. And but using corpses in all kinds of what we would now say very macabre and very grotesque ways, these corpses were not rotting. They were just there, and they became material that was used for all kinds of, you know, for windbreaks and also for barricades. And then finally, in the building of the bridge, some corpses were actually used as ballast to hold the bridge in place. That's one of the more kind of macabre realities of this battle, is that's not really talked about too much, but corpses were everywhere along that 70-mile road.
Well, once we get to the evacuation and the soldiers are out, what is the aftermath of this battle? How does this affect the war as it goes on?
Well, it's a pivotal battle in many ways. It was crystal clear, you know, declaration from the Chinese that they're here and they're here to stay, and this is a international, truly international war now. I mean, if it wasn't already with the UN forces involved, now China has intervened and is willing to spend blood and treasure to defend North Korea. So that's the first thing. If they had succeeded in their goal of annihilating the 1st Marine Division, it would have been devastating to our morale, and I think the battle lines would have been very different. They were annihilated. They were intact as a unit, and they got out of there with about 1,000 casualties, which is not a huge number when you consider that Mao probably lost somewhere on the order of 30 or 40,000 men in this battle. The 1st Marine Division went down to the south near Pusan and regrouped and was back in a couple of months. But it was a turning point. I think, you know, Chosin Reservoir was the place and the time when we began to recognize that this isn't just a localized conflict anymore. This is not just a civil war anymore. This is truly an international, a terrifying, you know, international war that is escalating. And, you know, the Russians were making more and more signals that they were going to get more deeply involved. And, it was really the first, you know, the opening salvo of the Cold War, the one time early on when the Cold War became very, very hot. MacArthur's talking about using nuclear weapons and sowing a permanent radioactive zone along the Yalu River, talking about dropping bombs on Beijing. It's a terrifying time in our history where we really, really did almost come to the brink of a international nuclear war, because by this point Stalin had nuclear weapons, and it was a scary time and one that we need to look back on and try to understand better and try to desperately to avoid these kinds of scenarios happening again. And one of the reasons that it happened, I'm convinced, is that because we did not recognize Mao and did not government as the legitimate government of the largest, you know, most populous nation on earth. You know, we had no back channels of communication. We had no way of communicating or interpreting his signals. And, you know, diplomacy failed. So these two armies were sent into this frozen wilderness. And it's like you can now look at it as almost a slow motion, you know, freight train wreck, you know, a collision. And that's because diplomacy had completely and utterly failed.
Well, this battle had huge ripple effects. You mentioned that had the Marine unit been completely wiped out, it could have very decidedly affected the war. Who knows if North Korea had controlled the entire peninsula? Well, North Korea is a much more unpleasant place to be than South Korea for sure. But to tie all these things together, what do you think are other legacies of the Chosin Reservoir? And what do you hope people take out of the story as they read about it?
Well, a lot of different things. One is that I think we need to be careful never to put ourselves in a situation again where we have a commander who has so much concentrated authority and power as MacArthur did at this time. You know, he was running the occupation of Japan. He was the supreme leader of the Allied forces, the leader of the UN forces, leader of the U.S. Army in that part of the world. And, you know, he carried himself like a god or like a demigod. And he was, you know, people back in Washington were scared of him and intimidated by him. And he had assumed so much power that he could do no wrong. And I think that, you know, we need to be very careful not to have commanders assume that much power. And that much kind of celebrity, I guess. You know, Truman was intimidated by MacArthur, didn't know how to handle him. So that's one thing. I think another takeaway is, you know, we do need to pay more attention, I think, to what the field commanders have to say. You know, the guys who are on the ground, who know the situation as it really is, and who have the highest stakes, personal reasons for caring about what where they're sending their men. We need to listen to those guys and make sure that it's not just a one-way, top-down kind of structure, but that we're really paying attention to what these field generals have to say and what they think. And then, I guess the other takeaway from this is the absolute importance, the paramount importance of diplomacy. You know, we needed to have some sort of relationship with Mao, but we refused to recognize him. And I think that was one of the major factors in this whole battle happening in the first place. They, you know, in retrospect, gave us lots of signals that they were going to intervene. And we just chose not to receive or.
Yeah, there are definitely themes here that you fleshed out that are good principles to understand and exist timelessly across much of military history. So, well, Hampton, thank you for sharing all this with us. The book is On Desperate Ground, The Epic Story of Chosin Reservoir, The Greatest Battle of the Korean War. So, Hampton, thank you for joining us.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks so much.
So that is the episode for today. First off, I want to give a shout out to the Spy Masters for the Knowlton's Rangers. Vic Austin, Chris, Rob Matlock, Alan Baker, Beverly Ingle, Jake Harrington, Todd Warren, William Ivey, Joyce Norman, Tyler from Colorado, Josh Reddick, Daniel Lawson, Marlene, Michael, Tim Clark, David Powell, Moondoggy from Ohio, Melissa, Chris Romaine, Carl from Norway, and Baron Fraser. I'll explain what that is in a second. If you like the show and want to help it grow, there are four easy ways for you to do it. One, like and subscribe to the show on the podcast player of your choice. This helps spread the word about the show. Two, join our Facebook group. Here we can keep the discussion going about new episodes, and you can talk about what you like and didn't like. And you can find this group if you just search for History Unplugged on Facebook. Three, we have an online store with t-shirts, phone covers, and other accessories featuring awesomely bad history puns that were crowdsourced by you, the audience. And you can find that if you go to teepublic.com and look for History Unplugged, or you just go to historyonthenet.com and look for our store there. Four, and this is really the best way to dive deep with History Unplugged, and that's to become one of the Knowlton's Rangers. If you know your American history, you know the Knowlton's Rangers were an elite spy and reconnaissance group in the American Revolutionary War, but it's also the name of the membership program of History Unplugged. You can join at three levels. If you join at the level of Scout, you can hear all the episodes of History Unplugged completely ad-free and get early access to new episodes, at least a week early. If you join at the Intelligence Officer level, you get special bonus episodes, like a 10-part series on the World War II hero Audie Murphy, a multi-part series called Ottoman Lives about different people in the Ottoman Empire, and a series called Rendezvous with Death that looks at biographical profiles of Americans who went to fight in World War I before America entered the war. The last level is Spymaster, where you get all that stuff, but you also get three hardcover history books, Forging a President, How the Wild West Created Teddy Roosevelt, Race to the Top of the World, Richard Byrd and the First Flight to the North Pole, and The Last Fighter Pilot, the true story of the final combat mission of World War II. Another bonus is, you can choose a history topic for me to focus on for an entire episode that can go up to an hour, and I'll answer whatever question you have for me, and you get a shout-out at the end of each episode. If you want to learn how to become a member of the Knowlton's Rangers, go to patreon.com/unplugged. That's patreon.com/unplugged. All right, well, that is all for my spiel. Thanks for listening to the History Unplugged podcast, from ancient Greece to the Cold War and everything else in between. See you next time.